But we're glad to have Constantine with us again for, I don't know, the 15th year or something like that. I think in the piece of publicity it says part 10. I think it's more like part 23 or something, but of the Theotokos that we were speaking about during these dormition seasons. So thank you, Constantine, for working and preparing and coming to us again. Let's stand and pray. O Heavenly King, O Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, who art in all places and fillest all things, the treasure of good things and giver of life, come and abide in us, cleanse us from every stain, and save our souls, O good one. Amen.
Father Joseph, Father Timothy, brothers and deacons of the Church of Christ, brothers and sisters in Christ, we gather again here tonight to beseech the Most Holy Theotokos to intercede for us to the merciful God and her Son, to fulfill some of our immediate needs, some of our specific needs that we have as human beings. The small and great supplication services, supplicatory canons, as we call them in the church, to the Most Holy Theotokos are numbered among the most popular services of the Orthodox Church. These two services are named Small and Great, even though they both have 32 hymns, 32 troparia, four at each ode. They both have an equal number of hymns, but the hymns of the Great Supplication Service are much lengthier, and they are chanted in a more festive way, especially during the 15 days of August, when in a lot of the Orthodox churches, Greek Orthodox churches, we alternate. We have the small Paraklesis service one night, and then we have the great Paraklesis service the other night. Just to give you an example, one of the hymns of the first ode of the small Paraklesis service, with many temptations surrounding me, searching for salvation, I have sought refuge in you, O Mother of the Word and Ever Virgin, from all distresses and danger, deliver me. Here we have 29 words, where the corresponding troparion of the same ode in the Great Supplication Service is much lengthier. We have 47 words. My humble soul is troubled by the rising tempests of afflictions, woes, and clouds of misfortunes overcome me, bringing darkness to my heart, O Bride of God. But since thou art the Mother of the divine and eternal light, shine thy gladsome light and illumine me. So the increase in words is not the only reason why this is called the Great Supplicatory Canon, but along with the lengthier hymns, as I said, this service is chanted much more festively during the August fast and also during Christmas in the monasteries and other feasts. Well, years ago in 1993, we published this little booklet, The Service of the Great Paraklesis to the Most Holy Theotokos, and at the end we also have the music. And it sold out in a few years, and I believe today the Monastery of the Life-Giving Springs, Living Spring, and you have to bear with me, I just got off the plane a couple hours ago and slept about 3 hours last night. And I almost didn't make it here, but I think Father Joseph was up praying for me. My phone froze. I don't know why it does that. It froze one more time in New York, and, you know, it was my GPS, so I couldn't get to my destination, and a policeman pulled me over, and I said, hey, you can't use this. So I had a nice ticket. But last night it froze again, and probably wouldn't have woken up to catch my flight. So at 3 o'clock, this huge truck went by in Philadelphia and just rambled the whole home. So I woke up. So somebody was praying. So once again, the great supplicatory canon will speak about the history of these two canons. I think it's good to know where they come from. And as Orthodox, we need to know our history and the people that gave us these treasures. So the great supplicatory canon to the Theotokos was composed and written by the Emperor of Nicaea, Theodore Doukas Laskaris. Now, who heard of the Empire of Nicaea? Probably no one. You all know about the Byzantine Empire, but nobody heard about the Empire of Nicaea when Constantinople was ransacked by the Crusaders, and it was actually captivated for about 50, 60 years. This is after the schism, of course, and a lot of the Orthodox fought, and they created a smaller empire to counteract the Crusaders, who again were in Constantinople. So that's where the Empire of Nicaea comes from. It was established to counter the captivity of Constantinople by the Franks of the Fourth Crusade between 1204 and 1261. I believe 1261, the Crusaders were pushed out by Michael the Palaiologos. So the writer of the great supplicatory canon is Theodore II Laskaris, who was the son of John Vatazis and Irene Laskaris. The father of the princess Irene was Theodore I, who established the Empire of Nicaea. His grandson Theodore II was very well educated in theology, philosophy, and his teachers were Nikephoros Blamidis and Theodore Acropolitis, but he suffered from a very serious epileptic illness, which made it very difficult for him to exercise his duties as an emperor. He had somewhat of an obsessive compulsive disorder, and this kind of turned many of his high officials against him. And at some point in the course of history, his daughter Maria was married to Nikephoros, the son of the Holy Queen of modern-day Albania, Theodora. At that point, the whole region came under the rule of Nicaea, along with Serbia. So Theodora, Maria's mother-in-law, was a very holy woman with much pain, which often takes place in the political life, and she learned to pour her heart out to the Most Holy Theotokos. So Theodore Laskaris, the emperor of Nicaea and the in-law of Theodora, was highly influenced by Theodora, who had developed the patience of a saint and the conscience of a peacemaker. So she suggested to her in-law Theodore, King Theodore, to place all his hope on the Most Holy Theotokos. And his ardent supplications to the Most Holy Theotokos finally took the form of the great supplication canon as we know it today. As his health was becoming progressively worse, he resigned from the throne of Nicaea, and he continued his life at the monastery of Sosander, west of Nicaea, where he was tonsured a monk shortly before his death. He reposed in August 1258, shortly after the Feast of the Dormition. So during the reign of King Theodore, the great supplicatory canon was prayed daily in the churches and monasteries of Nicaea, asking for the healing of the king from this disorder. Shortly before his death, he confessed with tears, and he repeated the words, "I forsook you, O Christ," or "I have abandoned you, I deserted you, O Christ," a very common prayer among the fathers. So the character of the great Paraclesis service is much more personal, as it reflects the cries and the anguish of soul of this often ill king. Be thou moved to compassion, O Virgin, and disdain me not, for life's tempests overwhelm me. But be thou quick, O modest one, and lend me thy helping hand, for I perish drowning, engulfed by life's misfortunes. Now I will continue with the more popular small supplicatory canon, which you all chant very beautifully tonight. You all chanted very beautifully tonight. And this was composed by a monk named Theostirictos, literally meaning someone supported by God. What a beautiful name. One supported by God. Or God is my staff. Some others ascribe this work to St. John of Damascus. Now, it is true that some of the hymns were written earlier by St. John, and they were included in the final form of the small paraclesis as we use it today. But the ecclesiastical book Orologion says that the small supplicatory canon is a poem of monk Theostirictos, which some ascribe to Theophanes as well. Now, it is possible that both of these names belong to the same person. It is possible that Theophanes, later on, became monk Theostirictos. Contemporary Greek scholars in the theological schools of Athens and Thessaloniki are of the same opinion expressed in the church book Orologion. Now, monk Theostirictos, once again, did not compose all the hymns, but he used some of the pre-existing elements of the canon of Theophanes the Graptos, one of the hymnographers, who had borrowed some elements from the canon of the resurrection of Lazarus, written by St. John of Damascus. So we have elements from many hymnographers in this great hymn that we chanted tonight. So the prevailing belief is that the small supplicatory canon finally took its final form from the efforts of the holy martyr Theostirictos, who was born in the beginning of the 8th century. He was born in Triglia of Bethany, a region of Asia Minor. Now, why Asia Minor? Because, again, this is the 8th century, and the Muslims are beginning to expand upward. The Byzantine Empire is losing ground century after century. And now the Byzantine Empire is reduced to Asia Minor. So Theostirictos lived in a region of Asia Minor, and he became a monk from a very young age in the monastery of St. John the Theologian, called Rough-hewn or Pelekiti in Greek, perhaps because it was built around a rocky terrain. Later, monk Theostirictos was elected to the position of the abbot to govern the spiritual life of 780 monks. Now you can see the effects of monasticism in the Byzantine Empire. I remember one of my studies in Thessaloniki, in year 1000, there were 150 monasteries around Constantinople. 150 monasteries. Just around Constantinople. The Byzantine Empire had 150,000 monks. What an army, a true army. This reminds us of the years of St. Pachomios and the islands of Tavanis on Nile River, where Cenobitic monasticism was established, and they had 4,000 nuns, 11,000 monks. The 8th century was very troublesome, however, in the life of the church, due to the iconoclastic controversy, or heresy rather, because of Leo the Savrian, who was the emperor who persecuted the church and propagated iconoclasm by instituting laws and decrees which he didn't always enforce. He was responsible for severing the hand of St. John of Damascus, who was a great defender of the holy icons. St. John of Damascus was in Syria at the time, and his father was working as an advisor of the Muslim caliph. Leo the Savrian, he got some calligraphers to imitate the writing style of St. John of Damascus, and he sent a very slendering letter to the caliph saying that St. John of Damascus was betraying him. So the caliph called St. John in and cut his hand off, his arm, and he hanged it on the center of the city, as Muslims often do. So that night, after sundown, St. John went to the caliph and begged him, "Listen, okay, just give me my hand back so I can bury it." But he took his hand and he went to the icon of the Most Holy Theotokos, and with tears, he began to compose hymns to her and cry to her and say, "Please help me with my hand, heal my hand so I can compose more hymns to your son and God." And after he slept, he saw the Virgin Mary actually take his hand, put it back. And after he woke up, the only thing that was still shown was the sutures that he used to tie his hand back. I know the rationalists can't really believe these things, but they do happen today. There's nothing impossible for our God. So after the death of Leo the Savrian, his son Constantine V, by the nickname of Copronymus, was elevated to the throne, who was very well schooled by the iconoclasts, and he even published some iconoclast articles in the form of questions and answers. They had their own theology. He was unfortunately a very gifted ruler, and when people are gifted and they're heretics, they do a lot of damage to the church. Arius was a very gifted speaker, and a lot of the philosophers were very gifted, but without humility, this gift can be very destructive. So Constantine V was a great military ruler, but unfortunately, he was influenced heavily by the side of iconoclasm. So after the death of his father, he began to uphold his father's anti-icon decrees, and he became responsible for the death of thousands of Christians, and especially monks, who venerated the holy icons. He ordered the governors of Asia Minor to persecute the confessors of the holy icons to the full extent of the law, to the point of execution, if they would refuse to deny iconoclasm. Now, these controversies divided the church, divided families, divided the army. So the political leaders rightfully understood that such controversies weakened the nation. And it was this controversy that really weakened the Byzantine Empire. And then after that, the Crusaders did a lot to get it on its knees. And then at 1453, Constantinople fell to the Turks. So more often than not, such monarchs and emperors as kings of the world are much more concerned about the state of their empire, more so than the faith in the afterlife and the heavenly kingdom. So most of them persecuted anyone who would dare to go against the religious or ideological position of the empire. So if the emperor was an Arian, then he would influence all the political staff to become Arians. And we got to the point where in the life of St. Gregory the theologian, there was only one church in Constantinople that was Orthodox, the Church of Anastasia, a little chapel. Everybody in the empire became followers of the heretic Arius, who believed that Christ was a creation. So just like every heresy is destructive, in the same way, this Constantine V ordered the governor of Asia Minor, Michael Lahanodragon, to enter the monastery of St. John the Theologian during the liturgy of Great Thursday, during Holy Week. Theostirictos, the abbot, was co-celebrating the divine liturgy of St. Basil the Great with his 70 priest monks and 710 monks. 2,000 soldiers stormed the gates of the monastery with loud cries and rudely interrupted the compunctionate atmosphere of the holy and divine liturgy. Governor Michael of Asia Minor, who acted like his last name suggests, like a serpent, ran towards the altar, pushed everything off the holy table, the trapeza, and struck the abbot twice in the face. There was an instant scuffle between the soldiers and the monks. And after this, the abbot instructed his monks to stay calm and regain their composure. Immediately after this, the governor took out an official affirmation, placed it on the altar, and threatened the abbot. You either sign this affirmation confessing that you are all against the idols you call icons, or you will all be beheaded here and now. Now, I'm bringing these things up because sometimes we take it for granted that our fellow brothers and sisters, our Orthodox over the centuries, had it as peaceful as we have it, with freedom of religion and relative peace. There were terrible persecutions. This was the command of this impious king, Constantine V. The fearless abbot challenged the governor, "Your emperor Constantine is the impious one and the sacrilegious heretical leader, and we will never sign anything against our icons, which we love, honor, and venerate." The soldiers were ordered to start the execution, and in a few minutes, 400 monks were martyred for their faith in the holy icons. And rightly so, because the theological basis of the holy icon is the incarnation of Christ. If we deny the icon of Christ, we deny his incarnation. The icon is strictly connected with the incarnation. Our invisible God became one of us. The aperigraptos, the indescribable, took human flesh, a human body, so he's now describable. We can depict the image of Christ because the Word became flesh. So after the martyrdom of the 400, the governor began to feel spiritually defeated, so he changed his tomb. He had the rest of the monks chained, took them outside in the courtyard, and set the monastery ablaze from all sides. And in a few hours, this beautiful monastery with all relics and icons was turned to ashes. The captives were then taken directly to the icon-hating Emperor Constantine V, who asked, "How many monks did you bring back to me, Michael?" And he said, I brought back 40 priest monks and 342 monks and their abbot." The impious emperor was outraged and yelled at the monks, "You evil monks, who taught you to be disobedient and rebellious to your king and to your kingdom? Now listen to me very carefully. I am Constantine V and I don't play games. Now come here and stand in front of me." The monks totally ignored him. They ignored the command of the heretical king. Not a single one moved, except a very young, brave soul, a young monk by the name of Synesios, who approached the heretical king and said, "Evil king, we are the children of one called Theostirictos, and we were told by this elder to tread upon the head of the devil and his iconoclasts." The heretical king went into a frenzy, and he immediately ordered the closest guard to behead this valiant young soldier of Christ at that instant. After this, he began to examine the mindset of every one of the remaining monks, who repeated the words of Synesios, remaining totally unaffected by the king's threats and promises. In a few minutes, the blood of the remaining monks was running on the ground, and their souls were being crowned in paradise. Finally, after the mass execution of all the monks, the king ordered to bring the abbot to him, and the holy abbot Theostirictos drew near to the king with half of his heart crying and the other half rejoicing. This is what we call harmolipi in Greek, a joyous sorrow. To have he just lost his children, but he was happy because they're in paradise. So the iconoclast king said to the abbot in a very harsh tone, "You murderer, you executioner, you kill 780 of your children with your stubbornness, refusing to throw in the sewer the idols you call icons. You will go down in history as the cruel murderer of your own monks." The abbot did not answer. He simply went to the wall. He took down a portrait of this king. He put it down and he began to step on it. And he says, "This is what you deserve." And he did this to provoke the king, to help the king to send him on his way to join his children. Now, where does this fearlessness come from? I think we spoke about this last year. It's from the faith that God is next to us, that we're doing the right thing, that what we're doing is the will of God. This is where this type of steadfast faith comes from. So this heroic abbot said, "Listen, king, I am an iconophile, and I venerate the holy icons, and I thirst to die for them. So go ahead then, because I am eager to catch up to my golden and blessed children, my crown and boast." Needless to say, the heretical king went berserk. But at that moment, a great noise erupted in the palace. The king began to shake as many of his staffers, officers, and commanders rebelled, threw down their weapons, and said, "We are lovers of icons as well." They were strengthened by the monks and also the abbot. They had icons in their chest, inside their clothing. His chief commander, Emilius, takes out an icon from his chest and says, "Cursed and heretical king Copronymus, I am a lover of icons. Go ahead and take my life." And the holy head of this commander hit the floor, and the evil king ran to his private quarters, paralyzed by the possibility of a high-scale rebellion. When he regained control of the palace the following day, he interrogated the abbot once again, and he received the same answer. And subsequently, this beastly king ordered to remove the abbot's nose, cut off his hands, his fingers, his ears, peel off some of his skin, strip them off by using something like vice grips. And then he said, "Take him to prison, do not feed him, don't give him any water, so he will die like an animal." That was the evil king's order, but the heavenly king had other plans. He provided his servant Theostilictos with very good guards who secretly supplied him with bread and water for about a year. And at the end of that year, Constantine V, the infamous iconoclast, died somewhere in Bulgaria, and his son Leo IV took over, who was not of good bodily health, but he had a very compassionate soul. Leo IV liberated all the pious defenders of holy icons, and along with them, our abbot Theostilictos, who requested to be taken to the ruins of his burned monastery, the monastery of St. John the Theologian. He was carried there by the hands and arms of the celebrating iconophiles. Now all the surrounding monasteries were begging him to go live with them so they would take care of him, but he refused. He wished to stay exactly where he lived with his 780 spiritual children, where he tasted the angelic life and the most happy memories of his monastic life. There, at a corner of the ruins, he constructed a wooden shed by the help of some of his brothers. And there, he waited for God to take him to paradise while praying. There, in the ruins of this Cenobitic monastery, the holy Theostilictos began to compose the final verses of one of the best hymns of our church today, the small paraklesis to the Theotokos. "With many temptations surrounding me, searching for salvation, I have sought refuge in you. O Mother of the Word and ever Virgin, from all distress and danger, deliver me." And there in the ruins of the monastery, he continued to pour his heart out to the most holy Theotokos and to remember his spiritual children and to continue to write the verses of her supplicatory canon. Shortly thereafter, an amazing miracle took place. While he wished to be alone with the memories of his previous monks, a great prophecy from the Old Testament began to unfold in front of his very eyes. We read in Psalm 45:15, the virgins, her companions who follow her, the Theotokos, the virgin, her companions who follow her, shall be brought to you with gladness to the king, shall be brought to you with gladness and rejoicing they shall be brought. The life of the most holy Theotokos and her son is the highest ideal in the New Testament, and young souls want to offer their bodies and souls to the service of the Lord, to join the 144,000 virgins of the Book of the Revelation, which is a symbolic number. So the Holy Virgin began to inspire hundreds of young men to camp around Theostirictus, although a fearful sight, without a nose, without ears, without fingers. You would think he would be repulsive, but the grace of the Panagia just attracted all these young men, and they were begging him to become their Yeranda, to teach them to become monks and live the angelic lifestyle. The holy abbot did not dare to go against the obvious will of God and the most holy Theotokos. So he accepted them all. And lo and behold, in a few short years, our Holy Mother returned to him all the 800 monks that previously occupied his monastery. This reminds us of the story of Job. Remember what happened to Job? Now, Job, in the Old Testament, right? He had 4,000 oxen, and God gave him how many oxen? Come on, I thought you knew the scriptures. Come on. you're not Greeks. How many?
Double.
He had 3,000 donkeys, and God gave him how many back? 6,000. Double. 5,000 sheep, and he gave them back how many? He had 10 children, and God gave him back how many children?
That's it, 20.
You can use this for animal lovers who want their pets in paradise. I'm sorry, but there's no dogs in paradise. And you can use this verse because the animals have no souls, so once they died, God doubled them. But his 10 children already existed in paradise. They already existed in Hades. They were not lost. So he only gave him 10 children. He didn't double his children, Father Joseph. That was a trick question. So once again, shortly thereafter, the once vibrant monastery of St. John the Theologian was rebuilt and restored to its previous glory. And God granted their abbot another 25 years to instruct them and guide them in the life of obedience, prayer, and holiness. 25 years later, his soul is very much at peace because with the help of the most holy Theotokos, he is now ready to go meet his first 780 children in paradise who sacrificed themselves on the altar of the Orthodox faith, gaining the crowns of paradise. He slept in the Lord on the 17th day of March, 807 AD. The last words that came out of his mouth were the beautiful hymn that we all chant on Sunday of Orthodoxy. Your immaculate icon, my own translation, I did it on the airplane. Your immaculate icon, we worship, O good one, asking forgiveness of our faults, Christ our God. For willfully you were pleased to be raised on the cross in the flesh, so you could save those you created from the bondage of the enemy. Therefore, we gratefully cry out to you, you filled everything with joy, our Savior, having come forth to save the world. Amen. Yes. monasteries. Okay, I think I confused you there, Deacon Basil. I mentioned that during the time of St. John the Theologian, during the 4th century, with the Arian controversy, that was the time where only one church in Constantinople was Orthodox. And all the other bishops and priests became Arians. They follow the religion of the empire once again, who was one of the descendants of, perhaps the son of, Constantine the Great. So the 150 monasteries around Constantinople were during the 11th century, like around year 1000 AD. I brought that as an example to really show the influence of monasticism and the strength of the empire. And the Orthodox emperors, they understood that orthodoxy heals a person. As they have the true faith and propagate the true faith, they will have more and more and more healthy citizens. And imagine having 150,000 monks in the empire. Would anybody need a psychologist? You had a monk right next to you, teaching you, helping you. So this was the health of the Byzantine Empire, which at the time was really called the Christian Roman Empire, according to Father John Romanidis. An easy lesson, except the question about Job's children. Okay, Father Joseph, I think we can close.
Thank you. We're going to let him rest tonight.
I chose this easy lesson tonight because I knew it would be a brutal day. So tomorrow we will... Yeah, get ready, because the topics will be a little bit more theological tomorrow.
We start at 9:30 okay. In the morning. We'll have two sessions in the morning. We'll have lunch together, and then in the afternoon, we'll have...